Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Roy Diblick is our guest today. He's a recognized perennial plant expert, a grower, designer, speaker, and author. He co-owns the Northwind Perennial Farm in Burlington, Wisconsin, and he has over 40 years of experience growing both traditional and Midwest native plants. So talk with him about what you should realistically expect from your perennials, and also take your gardening questions and comments as well. So I hope you join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Roy Diblick, welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me on. This is like too cool.
This is...
For years and years.
Well, how'd you get involved in gardening?
Well, the best thing that ever happened to me was I never had a horticultural class. I'm an outdoor ed teacher. I have a degree in outdoor education from Western Illinois. And my first job was working with kids at Cabrini Green in Chicago, taking them out to forest preserves to get them, get a feel for being in other places. It was a lot of fun. I had a great time doing it, and I loved working with kids. And the programs were all canceled in the mid-70s when we had the gas shortage. So always the first thing to go is the best things.
Yeah.
And I got involved with the St. Charles Park District hired me for a few years because I had a good work ethic. I'm 100% Bohemian. And when you grow up Czech, you know your whole future, you're going to have to work somewhere and enjoy it. So growing up in Berwyn, Illinois, and growing up Czech, you had to find what you love to do had to be your profession because you're going to do it every day. And with that work ethic, I just took care of the parks in St. Charles for a year. And then this guy took a risk on me and hired me to run his perennial nursery he bought in 1978 called the Natural Garden. And I didn't know a perennial from a doorknob. So I learned everything from the plants. The plants were in the ground. They weren't in containers. And every plant patiently said, Roy, here's who we are, here's how we live on Earth, and here's who we live with. So by the plants sharing who they were with me, I got to know them fairly intimately. And I met good people. I met Ray Schulenberg at the Morton Arboretum, Jerry Wilhelm at the Morton Arboretum. You know, by meeting good people who had passion, I just learned and watched how much they loved what they did. So it just kept falling into place. And since then, I think I've grown a little over 15 million perennials and native plants.
Well, yeah, you bought Northwind Perennial Farm. When was that? It's been
yeah,
a while now.
We moved here in 91. We moved up here.
Yeah.
This natural garden got too big, and I'm not really good at managing people. Humans have too many. They change their mind too much. You know, I've never had a plant, a salvia, that wanted to be... a rotituba. Every time a salvia, they always want to be true to who they are and be as happy as they can be being who they are. And humans, they just, well, one day they want to be this and the next day they want to be that. But I love them. You know, we have to love humans, but they're so fickle.
Well, Northwind Perennial Farm has grown a lot since 1991, as far as I can, at least in terms of the kinds of plants and the things that you offer. I'm looking at your website right now.
Yeah, we've slowly become contemporary with people. Before we were a place that people came to. You got to go to this place. It's really freaky. They grow stuff that nobody has, and people came out and they kind of liked the entertainment value of seeing plants that nobody grew, but they just didn't know how to use them. And that, I think that's still the case. People are unfamiliar how to live with a plant. You know, they look at plants mostly as entertainment or food. Can you feed me and can you entertain me? And that's a plant's role on Earth for humans. And so we kind of look at plants living in social systems. How can I put you in the ground and put you with another plant where you can love each other, nourish and care for each other, and live in a healthy community? So I think there's more and more of that, of a feeling of relationships now with people. We're looking at plants as you know, other living beings that share the earth with us. So I think our gardening is going in a really good direction.
And we have a lot of new gardeners this year.
Yeah, yeah.
Who may not know what to expect when they plant this particular small perennial in their garden. Have you been finding that's true?
Yeah, I think so. And the fun part is they're not being critical of the plant for not doing what they wanted to do. It used to be people, this plant got too big for me. This plant grew too fast for me. This plant seeded too much for me. And people had this idea that the plants were there to do what they wanted. And the plants could only do what they do. So when you want a plant to do something, people would get disappointed. It spread too fast. But that's what the plant does. It doesn't do anything it doesn't know how to do. And I think more and more people are patiently saying, who are you? How have you lived on Earth? And how can you and I get together to share a life of health and beauty together? And how can I create a community of being of happily and healthy together? So I really am encouraged to find that in all ages of people. It's kind of an awakening that plants aren't just entertainers to be there just for us.
Yeah. Well, Roy Diblick is our guest today. He is co-owner of Northwind Perennial Farm. It's great to have him with us to talk about perennials. The Northwind Perennial Farm is located in Burlington, Wisconsin, so it's great to have him along.
Just north of Lake Geneva.
Just north of Lake Geneva. How many acres do you have there?
Well, we have 10 acres. We grow 55,000 perennials. We used to grow 450,000 a year, and we scaled down to 55,000, and they're basically plants that I use in my design projects that I can't get from other growers. And then the other growers, I would purchase plants from them because they're readily available. So, I call it my matrix planting. It's kind of like buying a house. When you buy a house, you have all kinds of ideas of what you want to do, but you have to budget for it. You start with the most important part. So the most important part is the ground layer you put in that will inhibit weed growth. So you put a ground layer in that inhibits weed growth, and then you keep enhancing and adding to that ground layer, just like you would your house. You put the kitchen's your most important part of your bathroom, and then you do your bedroom, your living room, or your basement down the road when you can afford it. And most people try to put everything in it all at once in a garden, and the plants become too competitive. Some plants are more aggressive than others. So you have to look at growth rate and growth habit of a plant when it's a three-year-old child, like in a four-inch pot. That plant equals like a three-year-old child. And how will they grow together to become adults? And that's kind of the phasing planting we look at. This is a staged planting. Kind of like Neil does with prairies.
Yeah.
You seed the first layer of prairie, and then you keep seeding to add diversity. And Neil's very good at that. He's very good at continuously adding to his prairies through seed. And another guy that's good at that is Jens Jensen. He's in Madison. That's Jens Jensen's great-grandson.
Yeah.
And he does prairie recreation. He's very good at seeding continuously to add diversity to his prairies, because that's basically, you know, most mesic prairies were 12 to 18 species per square meter, not six plants per prairie, like you see in a lot of commercial prairies. So it's all about diversity to be healthy.
And as I look out my window at my front perennial bed, I see that I have planted. There are some things that, you know, are crowding each other out, and it just does not. I'm thinking, what would Roy Diblick say if he could see my part of my front area?
I'd say congratulations, you know, because you. When you become aware of it, that's how we all learn. And what you see now, you'll never forget.
Yeah,
you'll understand how that plant spread and filled in and at what rate. And then you'll know when you move it with other plants, what rate they'll connect and grow into each other.
Yeah.
So it's that constant learning. It's like being an intern for the rest of your life. That's what I am. I'm an
Terry,
intern.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Larry. That's fine.
I was going to ask Terry and Amherst to join in, has a question for us. So Let's go there. Terry, hi. Thanks for calling.
Larry, hi, and thank you very much for having the show.
Sure.
Question is, I had a Lily of the Valley plant 5 years ago. It has now taken over my garden bed, and I've let it go. But I want to get it out of there. How do I do that? I made maybe the mistake of string trimming it down about 3 days ago, and I want to know, what can I do?
You should go to your local high school and hire three high school wrestlers who are strong and ambitious. Give them tile spades and have them dig it all out and try to get every rhizome. And the nice thing is now you know what that plant does. And that plant didn't do that intentionally to hurt you. That's the nature of Lily of the Valley. But you need someone with ambition to dig every little rhizome out and then just start fresh with a new plant community. That is easier to manage. You want to plant the thugs later. Lily of the Valley is a thug. It's not a bad plant. It's just opportunistic. So when you put opportunistic plants in right away, all they can do is take over. It's not their fault. They're just given the opportunity to dominate the community. Yeah. So when it plants aggressive, you just put it in about the third or fourth year, and then it runs into the adult plants, and the adult plants will say, no, this is my location. I live here. You can go around me, or you can stop when you hit me. So if you want Lily of the Valley, you put it in when your woodland or shade garden is 5 to 6 years old. Not right away. It's rampant.
Yeah, it's rampant. Well, Terry, there you go. You got a little work ahead of you, or maybe you can find those high schoolers and help you.
They're ambitious.
Thanks, Terry. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Roy Diblick. He co-owns Northwind Perennial Farm in Burlington, Wisconsin. You can join in 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, Larry Mueller here for the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at perennials on the Ideas Network Garden Talk show today. Larry Mueller here with Roy Diblick of Northwind Perennial Farm. Join in again with your own questions or comments at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Melissa in Manitowoc emailed, she's always enjoyed Vinca Minor. And hers always looked outstanding in spring. However, this time of the year, it seems to die back and turn brown and look kind of sparse. Not all of it looks bad, just a few stems on each plant. Brown leaves, brown stem. Any thoughts on that, Roy?
Yeah, that's, I think it gets rhizoctonia from wetting and drying. So when you get the heat of the day, and the day's been very hot, and you get... And the soil conditions change moment to moment, especially square foot to square foot. Some are wetter, some are drier. And rhizoctonia is promoted by dry and wet. So that will, and that was something, that's something that will continuously always happen with Vinca. So you just have to keep replacing it. But when you replace it with Vinca, because the rhizoctonia population is there and the conditions are there, you're going to continually have that problem with hot weather. I would recommend one thing is that she could transition from Vinca, keep the Vinca, but when you have a declining or dead area, incorporate Carex pennsylvanica, incorporate some of our native sedges, the low-growing sedges. Mm-hmm. They have the genetics of how to live under our conditions, and they'll spread modestly, and they'll complement the foliage of the Vinca so you can have a more diverse planting. And the Vinca can mingle around the sedge. You can't put one plug. You might put three or four plugs in. And as the Vinca dies, you can actually transition to all sedges, and you can mingle four or five different sedges in, and then you can put bulbs and ferns and jack-in-the-pulpits, mayapples. The sedges are the matrix community that will keep light from hitting the soil. When you reduce the sunlight from hitting soil below 500-foot candles of light, weed seeds can't germinate. So the quicker you can cover your soil with plants, and get above 1,500 foot candles of light, you can eliminate agricultural weed seeds from germinating. So the idea is cover the soil as quickly as you can. And one thing, this might strike people in an odd way, is if you want to damage, say you want to kill your plants slowly, keep using wood mulch. Wood mulch, there's no plant that genetically has any knowledge how to grow and accumulate wood. And we've done that for the last 40, 50 years, and we've never questioned it. There's a philosophy, an epistemologic philosophy, epistemology, of why do we keep doing things over and over again, and we never question them. There's no place on earth wood has fallen from the sky 4 inches a year around herbaceous plants or woody plants. So every plant you put wood around, you change the chemistry of the soil to be nothing but oxidized wood. And the worst thing you do is the wood doesn't oxidize rapidly, like leaves or stems or flower parts. And because it doesn't oxidize, it reduces air movement and oxygen movement into the soil and also water movement. So if you get a heavy rain after 4 or 5 years of mulching with wood, the water won't penetrate the wood. It turns to fiberboard. And what it also does, this is the worst part, it chokes your plants to death. It creates a hard crown around your perennials. And every perennial pushes new growth outward because the flowering stems die and the new growth comes off the side of the crown, and it can't push its way through the unoxidized accumulated wood. So the plant slowly choked to death. And most people think, you know what, that plant lived 6, 7 years. That's not bad. That perennial could have lived for 40 years, 30 years, and actually had children there. Yeah. So anytime we start with, and it's just something we never question. And to be fair, you know, most of the landscape contractors, that's how they make their money, by spreading wood everywhere in the spring. You see bombers, 40-yard trucks of wood, shredded bark, just being spread everywhere. I had a group from Germany here, from Berlin, and they went to Iowa, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois to look at remnant prairies. They rented the car. They came back a week later, and Cassie got out of a little car. They rented a little car. Cassie goes, Roy, we have a question for you. And I said, geez, this is cool. They just went to three states looking at remnant prairies. How did Americans fall in love with wood chips? Was their question. And I said, you know, it's just something we never question. And we think it's to keep weeds down. It promotes weeds. When you put that down on your soil, you're raising the organic matter content of your soil much higher than most perennials need to be. Most perennials have an organic matter content of about 3 to 5%, not 8 to 10%. And when you make your soil richer, you actually have more weeds because agriculture weeds follow agriculture. And in agriculture, because we're putting plants in that humans want, these plants are dependent on high organic soils like your corn and soybeans. And especially now, corn and soybeans are chemically dependent plants. It's in a system now where they have no concept of organic matter. They can't live on Earth without chemical dependency because that's a system we've created. So when you look at using wood, we're slowly changing the chemistry of the soil because all the living beings in the soil have never experienced year after year after year after year after year after year of wood being placed on the Earth. So those are one of the things we have to look at and say, why can't we just use a living mulch? Like the sedges, the native sedges, perennials put tightly together. And when you plant perennials tightly together, they're like humans. There's not a human I know that wants to give up intimacy and being close to another human. It's just the nature of being alive. You want to be intimate with your species or other species and share yourself with the birds and all the other creatures of Earth. And the more we keep separating plants with 3 feet of wood and never let them touch or be intimate, the more unhealthy we get. And so it's not just the plants getting unhealthy, it's the humans that have to look at this and live with this get unhealthy.
Yeah, interesting, interesting indeed. And so the sedge, a living mulch, is the best way to go in your mind.
It's the way the woods were covered. If you went to the Kettle Moraine, and you could be there 200 years ago, the Kettle Moraine, the hickories, oaks, and cherries, the ground layer was covered in sedges. And the sedges penetrated deeply into the earth, allowing soil moisture to go deep in cooperation with the living of the oak trees. As Jerry Wilhelm told me this, he wrote the book Plants of the Chicago Region, now Flora of the Chicago Region. And he said, Roy, when the oaks leaf out, they leaf out, they, or they when they send, when they establish new roots, they establish new root initiation before they leaf out. And if the soil moisture is not proper, there's too much moisture, they won't root out properly. It's going to shorten the life of the oaks. The sedges greened up early to remove the additional moisture from the soil, so the, it was a system in play. And the oaks leafed out happily and healthy because the sedges reduced the moisture content. When you surround an oak with wood and keep the soil too moist, you're limiting the initiation of healthy roots. So the more we can plant sedges underneath our oak trees, the healthier our oak trees will be and the healthier the sedges would be. So it's really a
really
everything
interesting.
We do. It is. It's fascinating. It's a way we can heal the earth. We can do it in a beautiful way, putting plant combinations together. And then we can be healthy ourselves by learning how to care and love and nurture the combinations we create. So it's a future of success for a lot more than just the garden centers selling plants, you know, off their benches, which is still good. It's
still
not about marketing and sales. You know, it's not, well, can I have the newest rose or the new? It's taking everything beyond marketing and sales to how we can make systems healthy for everything, birds, butterflies, bees, pollinators, everything.
And Roy Diblick.
That's the cool part.
Yeah, Roy Diblick co-owns Northwind Perennial Farm, and every one of our lines is filled up, Roy, so our phone lines. So let's go back to the phones.
Okay.
Logan in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Logan.
Hi. Thanks for letting in our guest. It's so refreshing to hear your voices, especially after having your ears assaulted by right-wing radio talk shows. What I wanted to know is tips about growing Roselle. Roselle belongs to the hibiscus family.
Which
tips on Roselle, did you say, Logan?
Yes, it's a kind of hibiscus. And it's very tasty. I used to grow them overseas. The leaves could be used, and the fruit that you get from it could also be used to make jam, and it's splendid.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that. I have no idea. Hibiscus, we grow a lot of hibiscus, native hibiscus, but I'm not familiar. Is that the common name, or is that the genus?
You know, it's got a long straba something. I can't remember it myself. But it belongs to the hibiscus family, and it's grown especially in tropical areas, but it could be grown in the United States. But you have to grow it over a very short period because it wouldn't be able to stand winter.
Yeah, they have a tough time through our cold winters. That's what I'm thinking about. Yeah.
I don't know that, you know, you're in Green Bay, Logan, so, and that's a tropical plant, so possibly could be grown indoors. I'm not sure. I'll have to look that up. Roselle hibiscus. I believe it's R-O-S-E-L-L-E, Roselle hibiscus. I'll look that up. Stay listening. We may have some more information for you, Logan, as we move along here. Glenn in Fox Lake has a question. Hi, Glenn.
Cool. Hi. I have two trumpeter vines that are almost, they're probably almost 20 years old. I love the flowers. They're almost, some of them almost 2 inches in diameter. But I don't usually mow. I mow and I keep it under control. I haven't mowed for 3 weeks and I probably got like 200 coming out of my lawn.
Right.
And I'm wondering.
You better sell the house is your best thing to do and get the heck out of it.
No, I love them. They flower for about a month.
They do.
Anyway,
it's a beautiful plant. So what do you want to, control that?
Well, I'm wondering if I take a brush and I put some Roundup on each one of those, will that go back to the main root and kill it?
It would affect the whole, it would translocate through much of the plant depending on, but it's a very extensive, I would try some other way and go back to mowing over it. And just accept it as part of your turf. Yeah, just mow it and and it makes your turf actually more exciting than just boring.
Right.
You have something to complain about when you're playing pinochle. You know, on Friday nights when you're playing pinochle, you can talk to your friends about your diverse turf and then maybe disturb your turf some more and throw some white clover back in there.
I do have people that have dug up some of the plants and planted them in their yard.
I hope you told them that they can.
Well, they could see that when they dug them up.
Good.
So I was just wondering. I thought maybe the Roundup would affect the plant, but we'll just keep mowing around it.
All right.
We'll just keep mowing it and appreciate what you have. That's cool.
There you go, Glenn. Thank you so much for calling. Well, Lois and DeForest, it's your turn. Hi, Lois.
Hi. I'm so enjoying your humor as well as all of this educational value. Thank you. I bought at Jung's the seed packet called Prairie Seed. And when I read the instructions, and they weren't on the front, it said that it needed to be stratified. Do I buy it, those seeds already stratified, or do I need to stratify them?
Yeah, you need to put them through a fake winter. You mix them with moist sand for about 8 to 12 weeks and put them in the refrigerator. But it's... You'd want to do that in January, and then you sow the seeds in mid-April outside, and you can put them in little trays with a soil mix and put window screens over them. The window screens will break up the raindrops so they don't come down like big bombs and blow up your young children in the seed flats. But if you sow them now, they won't germinate. It's basically a way the seeds protect themselves from coming up in warm weather before winter comes. So they have to go through a stratification. They have to go through winter to break their dormancy.
Sow them now. They'll just not germinate?
Yeah, keep them in the bag. Just keep them in your refrigerator at a cool temperature. They'll stay a little, say, a higher viability. And then next January, mix them with moist silica sand. And you use about 4 parts to 5 parts silica sand to your volume of seed. And you get the silica sand moist but not wet, put it in a baggie, label it, and put it in your fridge for 8 weeks. And then just scatter the seed wherever you'd like.
There you go, Lois. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call. So hang on to those seeds for a while yet. You can join in too, by the way, 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Mary in Chippewa Falls up next. Hi, Mary.
Oh, cool.
Hi. As I've been listening to the show, I was hearing all about this mulch, and I just kept hitting my head. I am on Lake Wissota, and I'm participating in the Healthy Lakes program. So right now I have about 192 plants that we put in. I got them from the Prairie Nursery. And yesterday when I was down there kind of moving the mulch around, I saw a crawler, or I call them night crawlers, but I'm wondering if it's a jumping worm.
Well... What was it doing? Was it jumping?
No, that's the one thing. It didn't jump, but it's got the look. I took a picture of it, and it's got that white segmented part up near the head, and then the body itself is more gray, kind of a gunmetal gray than it is a brown worm. So I've got two things going on. I got it from my mulch from a reputable nursery, but when I asked them about the jumping worms, they kind of went, what? And I did read up, and I see that they have been found in Eau Claire and Menominee, so Triple Falls is not too far from that, and I'm just wondering if I should just take all that mulch off of there and, you know, just be done with it.
I would call Call the Old Brook Botanic Garden. They've got jumping worms there, and their gardens look fine. So I would call them and see what their issues are. Find out from other people first before you take an active role that might not be the most practical. And in Madison, they've had jumping worm. And just see what Oldbrook does. I know after talking to Oldbrook, because they cultivate the top layer of soil at a rapid rate. So some of the shallow rooted plants dry out quickly. But a lot of our plants are deep, 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 deeply rooted. So in some respects, as plants are newer, you might have to water more for newer plants. So once they really have a deep penetrating root system, 18 to 24 to 36 inches down, the jumping worm might not be a problem. And if you put in native plants, eventually when they become adults, their root systems are going to be down 18, 24, 36 inches. So if you have jumping worm, that's not going to be a problem for them to acquire moisture. If you dig down in any of our agricultural fields, not as in most of our agricultural fields, if you dig down about 36 inches to 40 inches, we have 50% soil moisture. So when root systems penetrate down deeply, a lot of plants are under the stress of water because they can get their root systems down. Actually, water moves up into the root zone with deep penetrating roots. They help bring moisture to some of the shallow rooted plants. So I would call Oldbrook and just say, I fear you've got jumping worm. How is it affecting your culture at the gardens? And get more information about it.
Yeah.
The last thing you want to do is panic about things.
Yeah.
Some things are inevitable. Yeah.
There you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Laura in Menominee Falls called or emailed, I should say, to say that she planted two varieties of penstemon, pink and purple. They were flowering when she purchased them in May, but now they're not flowering. In past years, when she kept them in their store pots, they bloomed all season. They're in the same pot, somewhat shady backyard. What suggestions do you have? Any comments on that? And what suggestions do you have for growing lavender?
Well, lavender, I would suggest is treated like an annual because it's a Mediterranean plant, or move to Spain. You can move to Mediterranean, move to Spain. But lavender is never going to do well. It needs good drainage. So maybe in central Wisconsin, but then you have to worry about cold where you have sharp drainage. And if you treat lavender as an annual, then you can budget for it. And that way, every year you're going to spend $50, $60 or whatever on lavender, and you can enjoy it and you won't get depressed about it dying. And the penstemons, those are hybrid penstemons, and they do well in certain parts of the country, but they're not going to do well in Wisconsin. They have no genetic knowledge how to live a healthy life in Wisconsin. And that's some of the things you look at when you look at the horticultural industry. It's market-driven like any industry. People want you to buy everybody wants you to buy their stuff. So when you're buying plants that have no genetic knowledge how to live in our situation, you just treat them as entertainment for the year. You budget for them. You appreciate them. And when they die, you don't feel bad, because they just don't know how to live in our conditions. And that's some of the things when you have to read and look at things. If you buy spontaneously, like I tell people, it's like going on your first date in high school. That's very spontaneous. It's just how hot somebody is. You're not going to marry that person. You're not worried what books they read. It's just how you be in social relationships. And when I see people buying plants, it's the same thing. They buy it based on, look at the blue flowers. Aren't they pretty? I think I'll take it home. And they have no way of knowing what they're going to do with it or who they're going to put that plant in the ground to live with. So you have to create these social ideas, because I know if I told people where they were going to live and who they had to marry and what they had to eat, they would rebel. Nobody would listen to me if I said you have to live in Burlington, Wisconsin, if they love living in Beloit. But we make every choice for every plant, and that plant has no way of getting up and running away. It has to live where we put it, and it has to live with who we put it with. So that's why we have to think deeper and more emotionally about how we put plants in the earth.
Yeah. Well, there are some places in the state where lavender does pretty well. I'm thinking Door County. There's a lavender farm there that
it's
does.
Drainage. It's good.
Yeah.
Traditionally, we have heavy clay soils in the southeastern part of the state. I think central Wisconsin has sandy soil. So if you have good drainage and you can protect it in the winter, you can protect the crown, because it's actually a woody plant. Because we grow lavender and sell it, but we can't really tell people it's perennial, because most people, it doesn't do well. It just dies.
Deb in Holcomb has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Deb.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Appreciate you taking my call. Say, I've got a perennial bed in the front of my driveway, very pretty. And all of a sudden, a couple years ago, I have like volunteer milkweed coming up, which is pretty exciting for me.
Uh-huh.
So it's spread quite a bit. And now I did see some caterpillars on it and butterflies around it. So do I need to cut that back so that it comes back, or what's the proper way to take care of that?
No, what you do is you put on a beret and you say to yourself, hi, right now you have a Monet moment, and you look at your garden and you become the artist in the garden.
Okay.
And you take this, you pull out the asclepius where it doesn't fit in. It's like a sculpture. When you take a block of stone and you sculpt something out of it,
sure.
And you just leave it where it feels good. So do everything emotionally, because the milkweed's going to spread everywhere. The Syrica.
Yeah.
It does not have you in its consideration. It doesn't worry about what your feelings or emotions are. So
well,
just
I'm
be
not
the artist in the garden and pull it out.
Okay. And it'll probably just come back because they have really expensive root systems anyways,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But the one thing a lot of plants know, especially dandelions, what dandelions are aware of, they know that humans have this belief we have to pull the whole root out. Not one human I know has ever gotten the whole root out of a dandelion. There might be somebody who's done that. But the thing dandelions know, humans are lazy. And they're going to try two or three times to get rid of the dandelion and never come back. So they'll have a life. If you're persistent with anything, you win. So you have to look at your time frame of persistence and keep going back. And you can keep that bed looking beautiful with that Asclepias syrica and keep it under control. But when you see it, you keep editing out the moments that make the garden look uneasy to you. Just keep editing, because it will always come back. But it doesn't come back overnight. It gives you, 3 weeks, a month to revisit it. So that's cool.
Yeah, I can tell you, Deb, I had the same issue on my front lawn area. The milkweed came in and it looked pretty nice, but then there got to be a lot more than I wanted. So I just started pulling out the ones that I just pulled them out. And the other plants came back in, and I've still got a few milkweeds in the right spot, but the other ones are pretty much gone. So there you go, Deb.
And sometimes you can manage, if you want to create a milkweed meadow, you can put bunch grasses in, canicums and spirobolus and little bluestem. Let them age to about 5 years old, and then plant milkweeds in between some of them, scatter a few through, and the crown of the bunch grasses will inhibit the asclepias from spreading into it. So they'll collide with that bunch grass crown when it's 4 years old, and they can't go anywhere because the crown is so thick. So you can create a milkweed garden that's manageable by simply putting in native bunch grasses and let them age for 4 years and become adults, and then put in, a group of asclepias. And the bunch grasses will say, you're not going to bother me because I'm established and I own this property. So that's another way to do it.
Deb, thanks again. Roy Deblick, our guest today. He is the owner of Northwind Perennial Farm in Burlington, Wisconsin. Great to have him with us. You can join in, too. Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mailer for the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mailer. My guest today, Roy Deblick, recognized perennial plant expert. He co-owns Northwind Perennial Farms in Burlington, Wisconsin. Over 40 years of experience growing traditional and Midwest native perennials. Specializes in highly aesthetic, sustainable plant communities for all seasons, as we've been learning, as we've listened to him. Of course, when you do that, you can really reduce your maintenance through your design of the plants that you put in. Roy, someone else wondered if you are in the business of, do you go out and help people design landscapes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I do. We have a, I do design, and we also set up stewardship plans for the gardens. So every garden I design, before the plants go on the ground, we give them a stewardship plan with basically labor, it's the hours to maintain. So roughly with the style of plantings I do, we've got anywhere from 15 to 17 hours per 1,000 square feet per year. And then we look at breaking every all the costs down as far as time, and then if you relate money to someone's time too. So everything is we pre-think everything out prior to doing it. That's why on the book I wrote, I called it the No Maintenance Perennial Garden, but it's K-N-O-W. And it's kind of know it before you do it so you don't overcommit to things. And then you can't take care of it. And a lot of the gardens I see, people just aren't, they just get tired. And then the weeds have, they don't take a break, and they lose the integrity of the gardens because they can't care for it.
Yeah. Betty in Dubuque emailed that she has purchased a home with the weed prevention cloth in the flower bush and beds, and weeds are growing through the cloth, which makes weeding challenging. She plans to remove the cloth and then use mulch. Yeah. But what are your thoughts? Also, some of the beds have rocks rather than mulch. She prefers mulch. Thoughts on rocks versus mulch?
The matting is just bad. It makes sense if you think about it, but if you also think about it, Dr. Bird, he was the head of agronomy in Michigan State University. I gave a talk with him. And we were sitting there talking. He goes, "Roy, hold out your hands." I held out my hands, and he goes, "I filled both of your hands with soil, Roy, how many living beings do you think are in those two handfuls of soil?" And I said, "I don't know, 100,000 or so." He goes, "300 million." Huh. So if you fill two of your hands with soil, there's 300 million living beings in two handfuls of soil, not agricultural soil, maybe from remnant prairie, healthy soil. And I sat there shocked. I can't handle this. It's very emotional to know that they're that. I didn't know that. So how do you keep those 300 million living beings healthy? The first thing you don't do is smother them to death with fabric and put wood mulch over that. That fills all the porous holes. You change the soil moisture, the temperature. All 300 million living beings are now suffering. But when they're in association with roots, and the living and dying of roots, the living and dying of roots are what makes the earth healthy. That's what we have corn and soybeans because of 10,000 years of prairie plants living and dying of roots of the grasses. Without the 10,000 years of prairie, we couldn't grow corn or soybeans. And corn or soybean roots do not give that volume of organic matter back to the earth. That's why it's in a slow, steady decline, our agricultural fields. We're not getting the organic matter given back by corn and soybeans. And that's why we're chemically dependent on our farms. And that at some point that will change because it'll be inevitably it won't be successful as far as our future. So when you put anything over there to control weeds, the first thing I try to say to myself is, can I outsmart a weed? And I find ways I can do that. And usually it's by smothering the earth as quickly as I can with the social community of plants. And when I keep the light down below, like I mentioned, below 1,500-foot candles of light, the quicker I can do that, then I can become the joyful gardener because I don't have to do that much weeding and hoeing. But if you surround everything with wood, the wood oxidizes, and that's why she has weeds. The weeds are germinating in the organic matter of the wood mulch oxidizing above the weed mat. So the weeds are living in the oxidized wood, and it strengthens them. Because the oxidized wood is what weeds love. They love that organic matter. Like if you want a chickweed community, just keep putting manure into your soil. Keep adding organic matter to your soil, and you'll have the most chickweed and henbit you've ever had because you increase the organic matter. If you keep the soil lean and poor, your perennials will stand upright. They will be healthy. And all the nutritional value they'll need is from the living and dying of their roots. And now we mow the gardens in the spring, and we leave all the litter there. We don't haul anything away, so we bring nothing to the landfill, and we let the plants live in their own litter. And every plant is saying, "Wow, I'm living like my ancestors did. I'm living in my own litter, and they're healthier." We started doing that at Lurie Garden, Millennium Park, about 2010. We mowed it, And we cut, if you look at money, we went from like 170 hours to clean the Lurie Guard, 160 labor hours, and they did everything in 8 hours with a mower. So if you just look at money and the time you can save, and in Fontana, I have 19,000 square feet of boulevards. The city does the mowing. We leave all the litter. We haven't mulched the boulevards. The boulevards haven't been mulched since 2008. So they save a tremendous amount of money, and the plants are actually healthier because they're living in their own litter and they're living, getting nutrients from the living and dying of their own roots. So it's that systems approach. And when we include ourselves in the system, which we have to because we created it, we can't help but respond in a healthy way and understand the plants much more clearer in the plant communities. And it's more economical. The cost savings is tremendous.
Todd in La Crosse has something for you, Roy. Let's go there. Todd, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, thanks. This is a little more of a kind of forest type question, but I have, with a lot of helpers, removed about 10 acres of thick buckthorn and honeysuckle from a forest, all the big bushes, but now I have the massive knee-high seedlings, you know, many thousands. Yeah. I'd love to remove them and replace them with the natives, and I wonder if you have any recommendations on how you would attack something like that. It's, you know, a little more in the garden. It's 10 acres.
I tell you, that's an excellent question. I was just at a house on Pine Lake that has the same situation. They got rid of all the big buckthorn. And what I recommend is to get a restoration group or ecology group like Tallgrass or somebody, Neil. They have the know-how to do that, and they do it at the right time. There's a right time to do that, and I'm not sure what that right time is, but if you call an ecological restoration group, Neil or Tallgrass or some of the other groups in your area, and then ask them when they replace it. The key thing to ask a group is, if you're going to replace this with a native species, when can I expect to see maybe 6 to 8 species per square meter? So that way you put kind of a challenge to them so you have diversity and see what their answer is. Some might say it'll be 12 years, and that seems fair. Take 12 to 15 years to get you up to 6 to 8 species per square meter. Because it can't happen right away. People put prairies in and they throw every plant they think of in the seed mix. And all they get are thugs. The prairie becomes big blue stem Indian grass or Tituba pinnata, and the New England aster and the goldenrods come in on the feet of birds. So they have a prairie that has 6 species per prairie, and all the other plants don't have an opportunity to live because they're shaded out by the native thugs. So you want to talk to people like Neil, Jens Jensen, and Madison, and they put in low grasses, Boudaluas and Schizacriums, and they keep seeding and seeding, and they watch how the prairie evolves, and then they keep seeding within the prairie, and every seeding they do welcomes the next group of young plants. They're a nurturing crop, not a group of big blue stem and negress that takes over the prairie. So you want to interview your folks, and just your question is, when can I get up to about 8 species per square meter? And that has them think a little.
Yeah, and getting rid of those buckthorn, those small buckthorn plants that are coming up, you want to get them before they drop their seeds.
Yeah, they want fruiting, right? So there's a process to that.
There definitely is a process to that,
yeah.
Todd. And when Roy was talking about Neil, he meant Neil. He was Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery was probably who you were talking about.
Yeah, he's good.
Todd, thank you very much for calling. Alicia in Davenport, Iowa, what's on your mind?
I have some sweet William that I planted from seeds 2 years ago, and I don't even know if it is a perennial or an annual, but it came back this spring. It did not bloom last year. They grew in nice little clumps, and they had real pretty greenery on it, but they didn't do anything. And then this year they came back and they bloomed and they're beautiful, and now they're turning yellow. And so I'm just wondering, will they come back again, or should I just plant the seeds that I collected next year?
Yeah, they're mostly considered biennial. The Sweet William, Sometimes they'll live a year or more, possibly. But you want to get the consistent color, you want to usually you start them from seed. They'll reseed in your garden, but you lack control of where they come up. So you can start them from seed. They're very easy to start from seed. They're not too easy. And you can do it in the spring, and then you can put young plants in, and they'll flower for you the second year. So you get a repetitive planting, and then they'll always have sweet William color. And when you grow them yourself, you can put them where you'd like them to be.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much, Alicia, for calling. Our guest today, Roy Diblick, recognized perennial plant expert. He owns, co-owns Northwind Perennial Farms in Burlington, Wisconsin. You can go online. If you just type in Northwind Perennial Farm, you're going to find his website. And it's a nice one. It gives all the information about the operation and a bit about Roy as well. So great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending some of your day with us today. Roy Diblick spending some time with us. He's a recognized perennial plant expert, a grower, designer, speaker, and author, and he co-owns the Northwind Perennial Farm in Burlington, Wisconsin. So great to have Roy with us today. And certainly he's looking forward to hearing from you. Are you concerned that your garden isn't maybe doing as well as it should? Do you need some help designing a space? Give a call, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. And you know what? I think we'll go right back to the phones. Robin in Portage has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, guys. I have two questions. The trumpet vine had been brought up, and that made me think of calling you. My trumpet vine gets a lot of blossoms on it, but some kind of bug, and I've never seen the bug, eats the gall darn blossoms. Do you have any idea what that might be and what I might be able to do?
You know, I don't even grow trumpet vine because it's too aggressive. So I don't really, you could probably check with your local,
master gardener,
gardeners. And, I know Phil on your show with someone, he's been retired, but that would be an answer. You know, someone, entomologist might be able to help you with. I appreciate like that gentleman who had trumpet. I appreciate trumpet vine, but I don't have the nature of putting that aggressive of a plant somewhere.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they can become too much for people.
Yeah, you might call or you can send an email, maybe a photo even, to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And the folks at the lab, P.J. Leash, is there and usually has a pretty good idea about what's going on. So if you want to give him a note to the plant UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, he should be able to help you out. Or I should say the Insect Diagnostic Clinic. I got it mixed up with the plant diseases. No, the insect the Insect Diagnostic Clinic at UW. If you type that in, PJ Leash will be able to answer your question for you. Sorry for getting that all fouled up, Robin, but thanks for calling. Joan in Green Bay, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I built a house 3 years ago at age 75, and I hired a landscaper. I used to do all my own landscaping, and he charged me an exorbitant amount of money, and he put wood chips all over, and they've driven me crazy. I have beautiful growths in the wood chips, and I've been trying. It would be quite a big job to rake them all up, but should I do that? Because the weeds
just leave them and don't do it again. They'll oxidize. If you use mulch, use leaf mulch. You can get. I love leaf mulch because it falls to your feet every year. You don't even have to shake the tree to get the leaves out. They'll fall to your feet. The city of Fontana tub grinds it. They harvest 15 windrows of leaves here in Fontana on the west end of the lake. They tub grind the leaves into one windrow, so it saves a lot of space in their area. And then they give the leaves free to the local community, and then they sell them. We buy probably 500 yards, 400 yards of leaf mulch. So we mulch our new plantings with leaves, leaf mulch. And then what we're trying to do is get away from using leaf mulch ever, any mulch ever again. And people say, oh, you don't like to mulch? I said, no, I let the plants live in their own debris. That's the mulch they've always lived with. But it's a very hard transition because I have to say, most people believe the beauty in the garden is when the contractor leaves after mulching everything. And if you go to places like the suburbs of Chicago, people are thrilled after the mulch truck leaves. Look at all my fresh mulch. They take a big inhale. Smell that fresh mulch. So it's just that we're a culture that likes to see everything neat and tidy. Like the indoors has to be our outdoors. We should look at what makes your life exciting for you. It's sometimes the unexpected. It's the dynamics of how something new can come to your life and bring excitement into your day. And that's the same thing in the garden. You let a few things recede, like the woman with the asclepias. Don't pull them all out. Pull out the ones and edit it so you can feel like you've done something artistically and use up some good energy.
Yeah.
But to pick up every twig that falls to the ground, that's the most tedious thing anybody can do.
Yeah.
And then haul it away and then bring back a bunch of broken up twigs and pay somebody $50 a yard to put it around all your stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess in your case, you dropped it in there one time, Joan. Just leave it. Just leave it, and next time use some chopped up leaves and clippings
of
sorts.
Or put more plants in.
Yeah, or put more sedges in.
So around spaces with plants that are compatible and live well together.
Yeah, there we go.
It's like building a team. You know, you need all kinds of different players on the Packers to make everybody successful. And that's what your garden is. Your garden is a combination of skilled players coming together to create a successful community with you as the coach. That's it. Your head coach.
There you go, Joan. Thank you for calling. Jim in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. So we have a city lot, and in the back of our city lot, we have some lilacs and other shrubbery. And let me just preface this by saying everything Roy has said so far is like contrary to what I do and believe. So this is a wake-up call for me. I've always kind of meticulously weeded back there, and I'm just curious what he would say. Would he say, let it go? Well, whatever should be growing there will grow there, and let nature take its course? Or would he say, no, you have to selectively weed back there?
Well, you can put plants in. You can selectively interview a plant. And when you interview the plant, see how they would live and put plants back there to smother up. You don't want to just let things go. That's not nature either. Because that area was disturbed by humans. That area has to be healed by humans. Anything humans disturb, we have to heal. If you let nature take over, like on a vacant lot in Chicago, vacant lots are the most beautiful things you can see because a vacant lot in Chicago, there's no earth there. If you live and die in Chicago, never leave the city, you'll have never touched the earth. But the weeds that appear in that vacant lot, they're creating soil. They're creating life and debris of a fallen building. So in your case, if you have an area you're always weeding, select a plant community you can put there that will smother out the weeds can be joyful to you and you can interact with it. You just don't want to leave it go. Because if you leave it go, you're never going to enjoy it. Because it's never going to be satisfying. And then you have no energy in caring for it. So you're not really contributing to anything either.
So, Jim, is this a shaded area pretty much?
It is pretty shaded because we have a couple trees interspersed, and we have lilacs,
oh, yeah,
and we have some
hedges.
But in the front, we have where we can view, we have hosta and a stilbe, but it's in the back portion that is just gets some sun, and it just weeds come up. And
right,
like I said, I've always just keep trimming them and pulling them, and then just thought I might hear you say, let it go. But you're not necessarily saying that.
Put some sedges in.
You can't. Put Carex pennsylvanica and Carex grisea. There's four or five native sedges you can put in, and they cover the ground. They'll keep the ground covered. They'll cut the foot candles of light down. You'll still have weeding, but you'll have occasional weeding. You won't have constant weeding. The sedges will be your best friend because they'll contribute to the health and well-being of the soil, and they'll shade out the weeds. And then you'll have the occasional weeding to help them to get some of the things done they can't do on their own without you. So it's always a collaboration between you and the plants. Like anything in life, anything successful is collaboration. It's not individual, look at me, I can do all this by myself. So you want to bring the plants in to collaborate with you, understand what their role is in your garden, and then when you understand their role, then you'll know how to contribute to their well-being and the well-being of your earth. And that's the cool part. Your involvement. Yeah, that's so beautiful that you can do that.
Good luck, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Vic emailed. He has your book, the No Maintenance Perennial Garden. He planted the Monet's Sunset Garden and is having a little problem with the blue sedge. Carex
flaca.
It seems to be getting out of control.
Yeah. Right. That's my mistake. He has to thin it or take it out. He's right. It gets aggressive after 2 or 3 years. So you have to keep thinning it.
And then what do you put in? Vic. I don't know his last name.
Sorry, Vic.
Yeah.
Sorry, Vic. But yeah, just take out a good percentage of it and use it somewhere else. It can grow in the shade. And just match up one of the plants in the pattern that you like and put that in place of the sedge. Just look at the pattern and see what plant within the pattern entertains you the most, and you can put that in the place of the sedge.
All right, there we go. Let's go to Russell in Marshall. Your turn, Russell. Hi.
Hello. I live in on a 1 acre wooded lot in a rural subdivision, and I've had this place for about 20 years, and when I moved here, I discovered there was a small patch of bloodroot growing. Over the years, I've nurtured it, and it's about doubled its size.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, every April, here I got all these nice flowers that last about a week.
Right.
But we are going to be moving, and we will be moving to a 9-acre wooded parcel in... Green Lake County. And I'd like to take some of this bloodroot with me. I wonder if it travels or at what kind of environment am I supposed to look for to put it in?
You can dig it out. You can mark it with a popsicle stick where the stems are, because it'll go dormant. You dig it out in the fall, and it'll be long orange rhizomes. And when you break the rhizomes, they bleed. That's why it's bloodroot.
Right.
And then you can look for the buds. It'll have buds set for next year. It'll look like fingers when you dig it out. They're all interconnected. It's a colony. It's really one plant. It's a large colony. And you just take that home and plant that in a shaded area with similar soil conditions. So it's kind of cool. You have to go back and look at your soil conditions. When you dig a hole, feel the earth, how the earth crumbles in your hand, how long it stays wet, and find those soil conditions at your new site and plant it bare root at the same time you dug it in October. And then next year it'll come up not quite as big, but you'll see the leaves come up, and it has to recolonize them. So it has to re-strengthen itself. And in 4 or 5 years, you'll have a nice colony, just like the one you're leaving behind at your other home for other people to enjoy.
Soil cool. with it or anything?
Well, I'm sorry?
So I don't try to take up a blob of soil like when you dig up other plants like hostas or
no,
something?
No, you really don't have to if you're digging it dormant.
Okay,
the roots are dormant.
Dormant, you just dig out just the plant roots itself.
Yeah, and mark the stems where the stems are with a popsicle stick. And that way that's where the buds will be. And when you dig it out, the soil will fall off and you'll have these long rhizomes. And just put the rhizomes back at your new house and bury them at the same depth. When you dig it, you'll see how deep they are in the earth. Plant them the same depth that you dug them out back in the earth at your new home.
Well, okay, thank you.
Yeah,
get permission. If you sell the house, just get permission from the new owners to dig out a few. And that way you're doing it at the best time for the plant.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Russell, thanks for calling. Kay in Wautoma, on to you. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I purchased 2 hibiscus, perennial hibiscuses, last year and planted them. They really did well for me last year, and they're coming up good this year. Should I have done something to help them winter over? I didn't do anything last year with them.
They are close to the house. No, those plants love you. Because if you start doing too much to plants, a lot of plants don't need us. And we have this tendency to treat every plant like a tomato. And when you start treating every plant with too much care, you're actually killing it by over-caring for it. So what you do with your hibiscus, if they're healthy and looking good and they're coming up fine this year, go bowling. Do something else. Don't put mulch around them. Don't overwater them. Don't put Miracle-Gro on them. Don't buy any products. Just enjoy that the plants are healthy, and they will continue to maintain their health by the living and dying of their roots and the plant communities you associate with them.
Okay, well, so it was the first time.
Go ahead.
It was the first time we planted them, and they were just beautiful last year.
Yeah.
The flowers were just huge, and they flowered for a good month for me, from about August 10th to September 10th.
Uh-huh.
But this year, I think they're going to flower a little earlier. They're a little more established, and they're growing very well. So,
yeah, that sounds excellent. You've done all the right things. You're a good mom.
Thanks, Kay. Appreciate the call. Phil in Kingston. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thank you. It's wonderful listening to your guest. He reminds me, I'm giving my age away, but I'm going to watch WTGW out of Chicago. And his humanistic, I guess he sounds like a landscape humanist. And he reminds me so much of Talassa Caruso, if anybody remembers her.
Oh, yeah, I remember her. I had her books.
Yeah, Making Things Grow.
Yeah, Making Things Grow.
She's wonderful. So he reminds me so much of her. Now, I'm embarrassed now. I had a call about a flower, and I forgot the name of it now.
Leatris?
The screener remembers it.
Leatris?
I'm sorry?
Leatris?
Leastra.
Leastra.
Leastra. They're growing all over the place, and boy, I guess they kind of send shoots or they send seeds or something like that. They're beautiful. They're kind of spiky leaves and so forth. They remind me of Spanish picadores out of Florida when I lived there. So can I move them or transplant them now, or would that hurt them? Or because they're like sprouting all over, they're coming through the front fence onto the sidewalk, and like how you described a plant like behavior or plant psychology or something like that, just like, you know, Talassa Caruso. How do I tame these little buggers?
Well, you really can't change their nature. So whatever they're doing, that's what they're going to do anywhere you put them. Is it Lysimachia? Is that what it is? Gooseneck loosestrife? They have a white flower right now?
It's a purple flower.
Purple.
And spiky leaves. If you think of, like, again, the Spanish picadores, like, you know, what they call in Florida, those down there, it reminds me of those.
Oh, okay. I'm not really sure what that is then.
So a neighbor called them Liastras.
Liastras. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that. Liastras.
No. Kingston?
What part of the state are you in?
I'm in Green Lake County, so south central.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I'm not sure if it spreads aggressively. It'd be fun if I could see a picture of it or something. I don't really know what Liastra. I thought Larry mentioned Liatris, but I don't know what that would be. There's a Epilobium is fireweed. that spreads rapidly by runners. But yeah, I can't picture anything pink unless it's a persicaria. That spreads aggressively.
At any rate, it's going to spread, as you say, yeah. Roy.
Right. Whatever you got is what you got. I would not continue to divide and put them on your property. I think you probably have enough. And there's no real way to tame something like that. But we start with, I look at plants when I begin the garden, that plants that respect their space. They modestly or slowly reseed, and they grow in clumps. So we try not to put thugs in until the gardens are 4 to 5 years old, if we even want to put them in at all. So the more aggressive plants, yeah, they're very difficult to manage because it's just their nature to spread and be opportunistic. So I would just thin it to the point of where you think they're under the, they're living the way you want them to be, and then get rid of the rest and just send them to plant heaven.
There
don't,
we
don't
go.
Give them to anybody. Yeah, if you give them to somebody, they might not appreciate them in 5 or 6 years either.
Do you use grass clippings for mulching, or should people use grass clippings for mulch?
You know, I don't know. We really don't. We basically use the ground up leaves. And then what we're doing now, too, is I met my wife in Chicago, and she does hugel culture. And it's a form of hill building. So we're building large planting areas out of weeds and lumber, trees that have fallen. So we're doing that to control water runoff. And she's planted these hugel culture mounds in Lawndale, where we live and have a home in Chicago, and planted fruit orchards and food forests. She's very clever at this. And I met her about 5 years ago, and I've never planted in yard waste. But these hills are kind of cool. They're built with piles of weeds and then 2 inches of soil, and planted with pear trees, cherry trees, apple trees. And
wow.
It's an Austrian practice, I think, of building soil with the debris on your property. And the plants
wow.
live beautifully well. Yeah, that's what I said. I was like, wow, I never planted in yard waste. So
and
it's
grass
another form of gardening.
Yeah. And grass clippings, if you leave them on your lawn, that's the equivalent of a fertilization per year. So it's
yeah.
not a bad place.
Right. I think using mulching mowers is a good idea. You know, and just
yeah.
leave the grass clippings. And there's a lot more approaches. There's a lot of bright people doing organic lawn care now.
Yeah.
And they're very fun to talk to. They have so many systems of approaches using different materials. We're in
it's
a transformational
cool.
time in horticulture, that's for sure.
Well, Roy, I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well,
we'll look
Larry,
forward
to you. It was so cool being on your show. I appreciate it.
Roy Deblick is the co-owner of Northwind Perennial Farms in Burlington, Wisconsin. Take a look at their website. I believe we have it listed in our program notes today. Monday at 11, Jesse LeGru is back to talk about computer bots and help you with your tech questions. But in the meantime, have a great weekend and stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.